We are in our series. We've been going through the Bible for about a year and a half now. If you've been with us, you know that we've been taking a journey through the Bible. A lot of history, a lot of, you know, I know the nerds among us who want to kind of learn the stories. You've been a part of that journey. And then the lessons that we can learn, as Paul the Apostle said, these things are written as examples for us. We can learn from their from the history, not just the facts of what happened before, but how that applies to our lives. We've been on this journey, and it's been about a year and a half now. We're a couple or so months away from getting to the New Testament or the Christian scriptures and the life of Jesus. That's coming soon, but we're still working our way through the Hebrew story, and we are in this section of the Bible where it's the history of the kings of Israel, and we're calling this little section, we're calling it Thrones, because it is covering the kingdom of Israel, specifically after the nation came together, and then they divided into two after Solomon died, and there was the northern kingdom, which became known as Israel, and the southern kingdom, which became known as Judah. And today we're going to see the end of the northern kingdom. We've seen the south has continuously had a descendant of King David sitting on their throne, minus 1 6-year interruption, but basically all descendants of King David. But the north has been assassinations, hostile takeovers, genocides. It's been crazy up north. And the northern kingdom is going to complete its journey and cease to exist. Their demise is today. We're going to see that story, and then we're going to pivot in the second half of the message to the southern kingdom to see a related story as they continue forward alone. And so let's jump into today's. We got a lot of ground to cover. Sometimes we just cover like one person's life or a portion of one person's life. We're going to look at a lot of things today. We got to move the ball forward, so buckle up, and let's jump in. First of all, a few weeks ago when I was on vacation, Anthony spoke about a man named Jehu, who was a general in the north who overthrew the house of Ahab and took the throne. He was a mighty man. And once Jehu died, we kind of stopped there with the north for a little while. But once Jehu died, he had four generations of his children and his descendants sit on the throne after him, which is like the longest tenured king succession rate in the northern kingdom. They just didn't have anyone last that long before someone got killed. So anyhow, here are their names for those who care. The names of his sons were Jehoahaz, and then his grandson Jehoash, and then Jeroboam II, and Zechariah. And these were the family tree of Jehu once he took the throne. Now, real quickly, I want to point out Jeroboam II to you because we saw his name last week in the story of Jonah. And I want to remind you, because Jonah was alive either during his reign or even before his reign, it's not super clear, but he had prophesied that Israel would take some land back, and it did. And then Jonah, you know, spoke at Nineveh. We saw that story as well. But I don't want you to think that what's going to happen in today's story happened right after the story of Jonah. There was a time gap difference. Jonah was alive before or during the reign of Jeroboam II, and there are several kings and several generations and decades to follow before what we get to today. But these were the four guys that we sort of skipped. Zechariah, the great-great-grandson of Jehu, was the last of his family line before he's assassinated. And that brings us to our last five kings of the north before the end. And they are, starting with Shallum. Shallum, he assassinated Zechariah and became the king for 1 month. And then Menahem killed him and took over the throne. He lived a long time, died. His son Pekahiah became king. He lived quite a while and reigned. And then eventually Pekah killed him and took over the throne. The north was full of hostile takeovers, man. It was crazy. And then eventually Pekah reigned for quite a while, a couple decades, and then Hoshea executed him and took over the throne from him, and then Hoshea would be the last king of the north, and we're going to see a couple verses real quick about these last two kings, and then we're going to wrap up the north and move to the south for the remainder of our time today. But first, the north. 2 Kings 15:29 says, during Pekah's reign, King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria attacked Israel again, and he took the people of Assyria to Assyria as captives. Couple things about that verse before we move on. Notice the King Tiglath-Pileser. This is one of three kings of Assyria that we're going to see today. They keep dying off. We're covering a lot of ground today. Kingdoms and generations and, you know, successions. We're just moving the ball forward today. We'll slow it down again later, but we're covering ground. But I want you to see Assyria is an emerging world power. We've mentioned this already, but Assyria is to the northeast of Israel, and they are a conglomerate of nations that have formed together and are really strong under the Assyrian rule, and they are becoming a superpower. To the southwest of Israel was Egypt, who had been a world power, but they're sort of fading now. And Assyria is emerging. And Israel, though they're not right next to either one of them, the stronger they get, even from a little distance, the more threatening they are. And Assyria goes on a rampage. Now, here's what will help you understand the story, a little history. Assyria had a tendency, and every kingdom is different in the history, but Assyria, their tendency was to go into a nation that they wanted to conquer, and they would conquer the other towns and the cities first, easier battles first, and sort of shrink the land, and they would finish with the capital city last. And once they took that domino down, they occupied the whole nation, and it became theirs. And so he would take people away from there as captives. The reason why is because the policy was that they would want to remove everyone from that land and move their own citizens of Assyria to the new land as land grants for them to make their kingdom bigger. So they conquer a land. Who wants to go live in the new land and be given a land grant? I want to. I'm an adventurer. I want to go west, young man, you know? So they would go and take new territory, and people would move there, and it would be their nation's new boundaries. And then they take the people who were in those lands they conquered, and they haul them away and make them live elsewhere, either in Assyria or in other conquered lands. And that was strategic, because by doing that, people would not feel at home. Conquered people would not feel like I can stand against Assyria because I'm not defending my own turf. Instead, I've been moved somewhere else, so even my existence is a reminder that Assyria controls my life. So they'd move people elsewhere and dislocate them and give their own people the land they conquered to expand their boundaries. And that was their tendency as they conquered lands. And here's the thing, no one was stopping Assyria. They won and they won and they got sick of winning. They were winning so much. So then we find that they're going at it. So anyhow, verse 30 says, then Hoshea, son of Elah, conspired against Pekah, and he assassinated him. And he, Hoshea, became the last and the next king of Israel. He ruled in the 20th year of Jotham of Uzziah. Now, that brings us to the end of the north. Verse 3 of chapter 17 says, King Shalmaneser, that's the second king of Assyria that we see today, King Shalmaneser attacked King Hoshea, so Hoshea was forced to pay a heavy tribute to Assyria. It was not uncommon for weaker nations to pay a stronger enemy nation a tribute. Basically, we could conquer you, but if you pay us, we won't conquer you. We can crush you, but if you'll pay us, we'll leave you alone. Sort of like the bully in school who says, give me your lunch money or I'll clobber you. Or perhaps the mafia that says, pay us for our protection, you know. This was one of those deals where, hey, we can roll over you, but pay us a tribute and we'll let you exist. But Assyria was not known for doing this. This is important to understand. Assyria did not want tribute money. They wanted to take over your land and move their people in and move you out. The reason they would take tribute in some cases is the word heavy, heavy tribute. It might be worth waiting a little while. They're still going to conquer the nation, but we'll wait a little while. We'll buy you some time if you'll pay enough of a fee. It's kind of like if you're ever, maybe some of you are handy people or you have a skill that people might hire you to do a job, but you're so busy that when someone asks you to do a job for them, you bid it really high because you don't want any more work. You're thinking, I'll bid it so high, they'll say no to me. And if they do say yes to me, and they'll pay me that money, it's worth it, you know? It's kind of like that. Assyria's like, we want to conquer you, but if you'll pay a heavy tribute, we'll leave you alone for that for now. But once you deplete your finances by paying a heavy tribute, we'll roll over you later once you've weakened your own economy. So Israel agreed to pay this heavy tribute. Verse 4 says, but Hoshea stopped paying the annual tribute, and he conspired against the king of Assyria by asking King So of Egypt to help him shake free of Assyria's power. Now, this is important to understand because Egypt is weakening, but they are still formidable enough to where if there's an alliance, maybe that will keep the Assyrians at bay. It does not work. It says, when the king of Assyria discovered this treachery, he seized Hoshea and he put him in prison. I don't know how he captured him. Apparently, he got him away from the city and he imprisoned him back in Assyria. In verse 5, then the king of Assyria invaded the entire land, and for 3 years, he besieged the city of Samaria. 3 years, this is a very common tactic. You surround a city. You're going to starve them out eventually. They'll surrender. It's better than just charging in fresh and shedding a lot of blood. So they besieged the capital of Samaria for 3 years. And finally, in verse 6, finally, in the 9th year of King Hoshea's reign, Samaria fell and the people of Israel were exiled to Assyria. They're hauled away. New people are moved in. And there is no more northern kingdom. Now, from this point on, in the verses ahead, I'm not going to read them all to you. We'll see one of the verses. But in the verses that follow this is an explanation of why. You see, the books of Kings and Chronicles, they're telling us the historical content of what happened in Israel. But right now, the author's going to stop and say, here is why the nation fell. Here's why Israel, the northern part, collapsed. And the reasons that the author gives are mostly spiritual reasons. For example, they forsook the Lord their God, who brought them, who spoke to their ancestor Abraham and promised them that he was going to make them into a great nation, who brought their people out of slavery in Egypt and brought them to this land and established their kingdom and told them, if you'll trust me and follow my ways, I'll bless you, that God's ways or God's best practices are the best practices for life. The maker of all things knows how to live in the world he gave us. But the people of Israel turned away from God, away from his best practices, and weakened themselves as a country and weakened themselves until they were conquerable. And the writer says in verse 13, again, and again, the Lord had sent his prophets and his seers to warn both Israel and Judah, both the northern and southern kingdoms. Turn from all your evil ways. Obey my commands and decrees, the entire law that I commanded your ancestors to obey, that I gave you through my servant, the prophets. He says, look, I've been telling you how to live successfully, how to thrive as a nation. I'm going to keep bailing you out, but they keep walking away and weakening themselves. And eventually, they're so diminished that they are conquered by Assyria. And that's the end of the north. So if you're following our journey in this series, there is no more northern kingdom. There's only what is now going to be called the land of Samaria. And that's interesting because the land of Samaria is now full of people who are not from Israel, although a lot of the Jewish people who are hauled away in the centuries that follow trickle back to their own homeland. But the people who are there don't all leave. So they kind of commingle there, and then over the centuries that follow, they marry each other. And the Jews who come back later on to Jerusalem down south hate that because there's a racial tension and prejudice there. And they consider the Jews and the non-Jewish people, or the Gentiles, as they would call them, who are up in the land of Samaria, who are, you know, interspersing, they consider those to be half-breeds or Samaritans. They even call them dogs. It's a terrible situation that in their hearts towards the Samaritans. And Jesus, in a few hundred years, is going to walk on the scene and have to address that whole problem, including the perspective of the people he lived amongst and their attitude towards other cultures and other groups of people. But that's another story for another day. We'll get to that when we get to Jesus. For now, northern kingdom's gone. Samaria is the land, and the southern kingdom is left standing. Can you imagine how scared you are in the south? I mean, you've just watched Assyria eat up all these other nations. They've eaten up your sister country to the north. Jerusalem's borders to the north of their land. They must feel vulnerable. Nobody has stopped Assyria from steamrolling over them. They are an unstoppable force. Well, let's move into the king of the south named Hezekiah. Hezekiah is the son of King Ahaz. If you were with us a couple weeks ago, you met Ahaz. He was a terrible king. His father, Jotham, and grandfather, Uzziah, were incredible. But Ahaz was a hot mess. He got caught up in his bad habits. He ended up worshiping idols that caused him to sacrifice his own sons in the fire, burned his own sons to death as a child sacrifice. Vile time and vile, just degrading behavior. And he neglected the country. The country fell apart under his leadership. It weakened militarily. It weakened spiritually. He even shut the doors of the temple, which no one had ever done. Since the temple was built by Solomon, and before that when David moved the tabernacle into Jerusalem, that had always been a place of worship. But Ahaz not only neglected it himself, he shuttered the door so that no one else could use it. It was such a shocking and jarring moment for all of Israel to have their temple shut down by a king who hated their God. And Ahaz was miserable, and he weakened the kingdom in so many ways. And eventually he died, and no one was sad when he did. And his son Hezekiah, as a young man, had to step in and fix the mess. We pick up the story in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 5. It says, Hezekiah trusted the Lord, in the Lord, the God of Israel. This is always funny to me. There was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before or after his time. I wonder who wrote that. That was his idea, you know. Hey, write this down about me. You know, tell him there was no king like me. I'm the best king ever. All the people say I'm the best king. So I don't know who wrote this or not, but anyhow, Hezekiah's like, his record is there's no one like him. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't think it means militarily, because his grandfather and great-grandfather were much stronger kings. But I think it's referring to his faith. He trusted in the Lord. In fact, let me just give you a little background about Hezekiah. He reopens the doors that his father had shut down to the temple. He rebuilt the temple furniture. It was never as elaborate or ornate as it used to be, but he made the temple functional and useful once again. And he did something very awesome. He went back and he revitalized the writings of King David, his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great ancestor, and King Solomon. David had written songs called the Book of Psalms for us today. And they were out there, but Hezekiah found those psalms and he reintroduced them to the nation. He added more to them. He increased the collection. He even wrote some songs himself and added to it and made the music of David a revitalized part of Jerusalem's worship. And he took the writings of King Solomon, the Proverbs, the wisdom literature, and he compiled them freshly. He added more that were not in the canon and made it bigger. He added some other authors to it, and he revitalized the poetry and wisdom literature that is in our Old Testament today. Hezekiah made this a priority as he reopened the temple. And so we owe him a lot historically. He was quite the king. It says in verse 6 that he remained faithful to the Lord in everything, and he carefully obeyed all the commands the Lord had given Moses. Now, this is the first 12, 13, 14 years of his reign. Things are going pretty well. But guess what's happening? While he's figuring out how to fix his father's mess and reestablish some healthy practices in Jerusalem, all around him, the Assyrian kingdom, the Assyrian empire, is a growing threat. The north has fallen. Other nations have fallen. They have to wonder, are we next? And that brings us to our main story for the rest of our time. In verse 13, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah's reign, King Sennacherib, that's the third king now of Assyria, King Sennacherib came to attack the fortified towns of Judah, and he conquered them. Same idea, same footprint. He comes in, he conquers all the other fortified towns. He's going to go to the capital last of all, just like they did in every other nation that they conquered. Verse 14 says that King Hezekiah sent this message to the king of Assyria at Lachish. Hey, I have done wrong, he said. In other words, I don't know why, but I've offended you in some way. You're trying to crush us. I will pay whatever tribute money you demand if you will only withdraw. And Hezekiah falls into the trap of paying heavy tribute to a kingdom who wants to conquer you, but is willing to drain you first to conquer you later. I'll pay whatever you want. Just give us some time. Don't conquer us yet. The king of Assyria then demanded a settlement of more than 11 tons of silver and 1 ton of gold. Wow, heavy price to pay. And I'd love to tell you that that was the end, but as you know, Assyria just came back a couple few years later. And let me set up this part of the story. They come back a few years later. They surround Jerusalem with their army. Everyone's scared. The king of Assyria sends his chief of staff to take a message from him. He's out there with the soldiers in the tents. He sends his chief of staff to go to the city of Jerusalem as an ambassador so they won't shoot him and give a message to the king of Judah, to King Hezekiah. So he comes to the wall, and meanwhile, King Hezekiah sends his ambassadors out to meet the chief of staff to receive the message from the king of Assyria. And it's not a friendly message. It's not a bargain. It's an intimidation tactic. It's a beat down is what it is. In fact, let's just see part of it. It says, then the Assyrian king's chief of staff told them to give this message to Hezekiah. This is what the great king of Assyria says. What are you trusting in that makes you so confident? And without reading the next few verses, he basically says, look, why do you think you're not, why have you not surrendered yet? Like, other nations stood against us and they lost. Do you think you're any different? Other nations tried to get Egypt to help them and that didn't help them. Do you think you're any different? Then he said, other nations have believed in their gods to protect them spiritually and they failed. Do you think your God is going to protect you? Please. You're no match for us. Nobody stops us. He is not there to say nice words. He's there to intimidate them to surrender. He says, and he continues his taunt in verse 23. He says, I'll tell you what. Strike a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria, and I'll give you 2,000 horses. If you can find that many men to ride on them. Ouch. Do you get that? He basically says, look, we are so wealthy and powerful. I can spot 2,000 horses. We won't even miss them. Can you have that many men who could even handle them? I don't think so. In other words, you stand no chance. He then says, with your tiny army, how can you think of challenging even the weakest contingent of my master's troops, even with the help of Egypt's chariots and charioteers? This is the killer. What's more, do you think we have invaded your land without the Lord's direction? The Lord himself told us to attack this land and destroy it. He's just talking trash now. He earlier said, no gods have saved their people. You think your God can save you? Oh, by the way, he says now, we know your God. He told us to attack you. He's sick of you. He told us to attack this land and you're dead. He's just trying to verbally abuse them into submission because they're there to conquer. And there's no winning. No one stops Assyria. He says, you know, twist your arms, say uncle and surrender or we'll do it the hard way. Well, the problem is that they're at the wall of Jerusalem and all the people of Jerusalem are gathered near the wall. They're listening. They're going to spread the word throughout the city of what they're hearing. And the messengers from the king Hezekiah know that people are listening and it's going to cause panic. So they're going to ask a favor of this chief of staff, which is going to backfire on them. It says in verse 26, then Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, Shebna, and Joah, they said to the Assyrian chief of staff, hey, please speak to us in Aramaic, for we understand it well. We know you're multilingual, you're speaking in Hebrew, that's cool, but here's the deal. We speak Aramaic, speak in Aramaic instead. Don't speak in Hebrew, for the people on the wall will hear. We're afraid that what you're saying is going to bother the people who are listening. Well, that kind of backfires because the chief of staff is trying to intimidate them. He's like, oh, you don't like that, do you? Well, so he says to them, in verse 27, Sennacherib's chief of staff replied, do you think my master sent this message only to you and to your master? No, he wants all the people to hear it. For when we put the city under siege, they will suffer along with you. They will be so hungry and thirsty that they will eat their own dung and drink their own urine. And then he turns his attention away from them and says, hey, everybody, and he repeats the whole message over at the top of his lungs. Don't think you can win. Nobody wins. Don't think Egypt can help you. Egypt has helped nobody. We always overcome. Don't think your gods can help you. No other nation's gods have helped them. Yours won't help you. Your God sent us. He's sick of you. And we're going to make you eat your own feces if you don't surrender. I mean, just brutal taunting. He continues in verse 31. He says, hey, don't listen to Hezekiah. These are the terms from the king of Assyria he's offering. Make peace with me, open the gates and come out, then each of you can continue eating from your own grapevine and fig tree and drinking from your own well, and then I will arrange to take you to another land like this one, a land of grain and new wine, of bread and vineyards and olive groves and honey. You see, he's so funny. He's like trying to spin it into a good thing. It'll be good. We're going to take you out of your land that you've always lived in and bring you to a nice, awesome place somewhere else, like a resort. It'll be great. We're going to take your land and give it to our people and haul you away. You'll love it. And he's just pitching this idea. Then he says, hey, choose life instead of death. Don't listen to Hezekiah when he tries to mislead you by saying the Lord will rescue us. Have the gods, he said, have the gods of any other nations ever saved their people from the king of Assyria? You don't stand a chance. And then he leaves and waits for Hezekiah to decide to, what's he gonna do? It's your move. When Hezekiah, chapter 19, verse 1, when Hezekiah heard their report, he tore his clothes and put on burlap, and he went into the temple of the Lord, the very temple that his father once shuttered closed, but he has reopened and reestablished. He goes in there to seek God's face. It says he sent, verse 2, he sent Eliakim, the palace administrator, Shebna, the court secretary, and the leading priest, all dressed in burlap, to the prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz. I got to pause real quick here and point out Isaiah to you. Isaiah is a prophet in the southern kingdom. We have met over the last few months some prophets in the northern kingdom like Elijah, Elisha, Micaiah, Jonah. But there are several prophets in the southern kingdom that we're going to get to meet over the next few weeks before we wrap this up. And Isaiah is one of them. He writes a whole lot of his prophecies down in a book that is contained in our Old Testament still, our Hebrew writings. It's called the Book of Isaiah. But he's introduced here. The king has sent his messengers to the prophet Isaiah to tell him what just got said. Verse 3, they told him, hey, this is what King Hezekiah says. Today is a day of trouble, of insults, and disgrace. It's like when a child is ready to be born, but the mother has no strength to deliver the baby. It's bad. But perhaps the Lord your God has heard the Assyrian chief of staff, sent by the king to defy the living God, and will punish him for his words. Oh, pray for those of us who are left. They're petrified. There is no win here, it would seem. Verse 5, after King Hezekiah's officials delivered the king's message to Isaiah, the prophet said, say to your master, this is what the Lord says. Do not be disturbed by this blasphemous speech against me from the Assyrian king's messengers. Verse 7, listen, I myself will move against him, and the king will receive a message that he is needed at home, so he'll return to his land where I will have him killed with a sword. That sounds good to Israel, like get him out of here. And sure enough, in verse 9, soon afterward, King Sennacherib received word that King Tirhaka of Ethiopia was leading an army to fight against him. Ethiopia was down by Egypt, a little further away. They normally weren't a problem to someone like Assyria, but for some reason they were leading an entourage to take some Assyrian-claimed territory. And Assyria thinks, we can handle Ethiopia, but we don't need to be distracted by Jerusalem while we do it. So they pulled back to go face Ethiopia, set their tents up over there, and go to battle there first. But before they left a message with Jerusalem. It says, before leaving to meet the attack, the king of Assyria sent messengers back to Hezekiah in Jerusalem with this message. So he's going to leave to face this other threat, but he leaves a written message. Before his messenger said the message, now he wrote it out, or he texted it. He emailed it, you know. He's like, here's the new message. And it was the same trash talk. Don't think you can possibly beat us. Don't trust in your God. No other God has saved their people from them. You won't survive either. we're gonna crush you. Your God told us to come here. Basically, just rubbing their face in it. And then basically he says, I'll be back. And he leaves. I will terminate you later. So he leaves them alone and goes his way. What does Hezekiah do? They're gone, not for long. The letter says they'll be back. What does Hezekiah do in the gap? Does he get the army together? Does he recruit some older people and younger people to make the army bigger? Does he train them harder? Does he find some more? Does he make some more weapons? Does he find some nations around them that they could hire to help them in the fight to come? What does Hezekiah do now with a threat set to return in such a desperate situation? Look at verse 14. After Hezekiah received the letter from the messengers and read it, he went up to the Lord's temple, the temple his father once shut down, but he has reopened and reestablished. And he went to the temple and he spread it out before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed this prayer before the Lord. He got down in the temple, he spread out the letter and said, God, here's the threat. I'm going to talk to you. There are some who would say that's a waste of time. Perhaps you've ever been in a spot in your life where someone told you, what are you doing? I'm going to pray. Prayer? Has it come to that? or they're like, get off your knees and fight like a man, we got to do something here. I've heard that from a Christian before when I was a younger pastor. Just the dismissal. I mean, people of faith just dismiss. Oh, prayer? What? We got to do something. That's what Hezekiah was doing. He's like, I know what you're saying, but there's a lot that needs to be done. But here's the thing. I'm going to come to God first. But Hezekiah, there's a battle coming. You got to get ready. He goes, I know. This is how I fight my battles. This is how I fight. I'm going to come to God and say, God, you're first and you're throughout. Because honestly, you can save us supernaturally, or you can give us the strength to save ourselves, or the wisdom to know what to do, or you can just tell us to accept your will and trust. But I need you. And Hezekiah spreads it out and he prays. And I won't read the whole prayer, but here's a little bit of it here. In verse 17, Hezekiah says, it is true, Lord. It is true that the kings of Assyria, they have destroyed all these nations. And they have thrown the gods of these nations into the fire. And they've burned them. But of course the Assyrians could destroy them. They were not gods at all. Only idols of wood and stone shaped by human hands. Hezekiah says the politically incorrect call out of all the other religions out loud. He says, of course those nations' beliefs didn't help them. They made idols with their hands and worshiped things that they could create from nature or from their own handy, and they put superstitious powers and said, these are our gods. He says, of course those things couldn't save them. Of course people could burn up what someone else made with their hands. What a puny idea of God. But he says, then he says this. Now, O Lord our God, now Lord of all creation, now monotheistic creator of the universe, the God of all, who is powerful enough to make everything and personal enough to know us. Now, O Lord our God, rescue us from his power. Then all the kingdoms of the earth will know that you alone, O Lord our God. He puts his trust in the Lord. And while he does, it says in verse 20 that then Isaiah, the son of Amoz, the prophet, sent this message to Hezekiah. He says, hey, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I have heard your prayer about King Sennacherib of Assyria. And I'm not going to read it to you, but Isaiah goes into a long diatribe of eloquent speaking like a prophet would do. And I'm not throwing stones because I'm pretty long-winded and wordy myself. He just goes into a long words about how God's going to step in and save the day. And sure enough, he does. And I'll just read you the end of the story, and we'll be done reading verses for this morning. Here's how it ends, verse 35. That night, just a little background here, Assyria has already left them and is going in tents to face the Ethiopian attack. They're away from Israel. That night, the angel of the Lord went out to the Assyrian camp and killed 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. Wow, that's quite an ordeal. When the surviving Assyrians woke up the next morning, they found corpses everywhere. How creepy would that be? You go to bed, you're like, man, we're the best. No one's going to stop us. Oh, we always win. And then some wake up and they're like, what happened? A bunch of the soldiers are dead. There's X-Files type stuff going on here, man. Like, what happened while we were asleep? They're all freaked out, you know? Good news, I'm alive. Bad news, we're small. It says, then King Sennacherib of Assyria, he broke camp, and he returned to his own land. He went home to his capital of Nineveh. We saw Nineveh last week. That was where Jonah, decades earlier, generations earlier, had gone to minister and help them through a time. But seasons have passed since then. The king of Assyria goes back to Nineveh, and he stayed there. Check out verse 37. This is our last verse. One day, while he was worshiping in the temple of his god Nisroch, his sons, Adrammelech and Sharezer, killed him with their swords. Wow. Now, again, these kings were known to have lots of children. These were men who, they took women wherever they wanted to and impregnated them because they're the king. Bless God, I'm going to do what I want to do. They had lots of kids, and two of his sons killed him. Now, I'm going to guess that this king was not going to win a Father of the Year award in the first place. He doesn't seem like a very nice guy. You know what I'm saying? He's out there. Look at how he treated the other nations they conquered and mistreated. I'm sure he was a real piece of work. And he comes home for a while, and his son's like, let's kill the guy, man. So they go into the temple while he's worshiping, and they kill him. Then they escape to the land of Ararat, and another son, Esarhaddon, becomes the next king of Assyria. And just so you know, without reading it in Scripture, because it's not there, but here's the historical backstory of what happens last. From this point on, Assyria is not... Well, they're on the decline. They have peaked in their kingdom. They were an emerging power, but this became their undoing. They've gotten to the top, but when the king was killed in this situation, and they lost that battle, all those men got killed, and now the king's assassinated, the kingdom has to step back and regroup. Is the new king capable? What's it like? What are we going to do? Let's figure this out. And they plateaued, and then they began to decline. And as they declined and they weakened, their power reach weakened out of their grasp. While they began to go into decline over the next few decades, to the south of them, another kingdom saw the opportunity and began to emerge as the next power to be. It was known as Babylon, and we're going to get to know Babylon down the road a little ways. But before we get into that story, Assyria is in decline. And that's where we stop today. We talked about kingdoms today. We talked about nations. We saw the Assyrian Empire grow until it peaked and started to decline. We saw the northern kingdom of Israel be destroyed, never to be a nation again, just the land of Samaria. We saw the southern kingdom survive a true scare and win. And we're talking about kingdoms and nations, and perhaps you're thinking about nations yourself because, you know, this was July 4th weekend, you know, you've been shooting off fireworks and trying to save your fingers and enjoy, you know, this has been a fun week, you know. And maybe you're thinking in terms of empires, you know. Oceans rise, kingdoms fall, you'll be back. Anyhow, maybe you're thinking about that kind of stuff. I don't know. But whatever it may be, I want to turn our attention as we land this plane to you as an individual. Forget the empires, forget the kingdoms. Think about yourself. As we land this message, I want to ask you a question personally from Hezekiah, from what Hezekiah did when he was in trouble. And I want this question to be something you think about this week. It goes like this. Where do you turn in a crisis? That's the question. And I want you to think about it honestly. Look backwards. In the past, when you faced a crisis, where have you turned? Be honest. Where do you tend to go in a crisis? Are you in one right now? Where have you been turning? And if you're not in one yet, think about this. Where, when a crisis comes my way, and here's just a little life prediction, crises will come into our lives. Where do you turn in a crisis? Do you turn to the bottle, to alcohol because you can drown your sorrows? Do you turn to pills or narcotics of some kind because, after all, you can escape from it all? Of course, the problem is once you come out of that, the problems are still there and you maybe have created some new ones. Where do you turn? Maybe you turn to face it and fight. I'm going to go fight the thing. I'm going to go take it heads on. I'm going to do what I have to do. I'm going to challenge it. Maybe I'm going to do unethical things. I'm going to do what I have to do to get ahead. I'm going to get my people around me, even if I got to mistreat other people to make me feel better about myself or look better, even if it hurts somebody else. I'm going to do what I have to do because it's about me getting through this crisis. Maybe it's a health or financial or relationship or something else. Where do you turn? What is your go-to reaction when a crisis comes? Now, I advocate for healthy activity. Not unethical activity, but healthy activity. But here's the question. Where do you turn first? And where do you turn repeatedly? And where do you turn primarily? Hezekiah said, I turn to God. These are things that we can do, sure. But I'm going to come to God first. Where do you turn in a crisis? Say, God, I don't know how it's going to work out. You can fix it. Or you can show me how to do my part to fix it, or you can show me your will and teach me to trust you. Either way, this thing's bigger than me. I turn to you. This is how I fight my battles. And Lord, I feel surrounded by what's going on in my life. I feel surrounded by what's happening. But God, I remember that story in the Bible about Elisha. They were surrounded by enemies and they were scared, but then you opened their eyes and they saw around the enemy was a host of angel armies all around them, and that you're bigger than the things that surround us. You're bigger than our problems. You're greater, you're stronger, you're higher than any other. And God, I turn to you. Where do you turn in a crisis? I'm saying don't go to escapism. That's not going to help. Don't do unethical things. That's never right. Do what you can do, but turn to God first, maybe. And turn to God again and again. And say, God, I need you in what I'm facing right now. Maybe it's the crisis of grief. It could be anything. You got to get me through. This is how I fight my battles. Now, we're going to move the story forward. We got a few more kings to see in the south before that kingdom stops to exist. And then we have a couple little stories after that about what happens in the interim. And then we get to Jesus this fall or this winter. But for today, I hope that as people of faith, can I say this? I hope that as people who consider ourselves people of faith, that prayer is not an afterthought. What, has it come to that? That God is not the thing that we say, if I have time, I'll do that too. I'm just too busy figuring this thing out. But that we would start to turn first and say, God, I need you. I need you. And my prayer is that somewhere in a church full of gathering people worshiping this morning, you're like, Arlen, that's where I'm at. I'm going to put God in the middle of my plan of attack. Let's pray.